This is disc number 3.
Gabriel had seen behavior like Gila's before, as a child, whenever people had entered the Alon home. Death had left its mark on Gabriel's face, just as Birkenau had stained the face of his mother. Gila couldn't gaze long into his eyes because she feared what she might see there.
He wasn't well before this. He's been hiding it, of course, even from the Prime Minister.
Gabriel wasn't surprised. He knew Shamron had been covertly battling various ailments for years. The old man's health, like almost every other aspect of his life, was a closely held secret.
Is it the kidneys?
Gila shook her head.
The cancer is back.
I thought they got it all.
So did Ari, she said. And that's not all. His lungs are a mess from the cigarettes. Tell him not to smoke so much.
He never listens to me.
You're the only one he listens to. He loves you like a son, Gabriel. Sometimes I think he loves you more than Jonathan.
Don't be silly, Gila.
He's never happier than when you're sitting on the terrace together in Tiberias.
We're usually arguing.
He likes arguing with you, Gabriel.
I've gathered that.
On the television, cabinet ministers and security chiefs were arriving at the Prime Minister's office for an emergency session. Under ordinary circumstances, Shamron would have been among them. Gabriel looked at Gila. She was pulling at the torn leather of Shamron's jacket.
It was Ari, wasn't it? She asked. It was Ari who dragged you into this life after the Munich massacre.
Gabriel looked at the emergency lights flashing on the television screen and nodded absently.
You were in the army?
No, I'd finished with the army. I was studying at Bezalel Academy of Art by then. Ari came to see me a few days after the hostages had been killed. No one knew it then, but Golda had already given the order to kill everyone involved.
Why did he select you?
I spoke languages, and he saw things in my army fitness reports, qualities he thought would make me suitable for the kind of work he had in mind.
Killing at close range, face to face. That's how you did it, isn't it?
Yes, Gila.
How many?
Gila.
How many, Gabriel?
6, he said. I killed 6 of them.
She touched the gray hair at his temples.
But you were just a boy.
It's easier when you're a boy. It gets harder as you get older.
But you did it anyway. You were the one they sent to kill Abu Jihad, weren't you? You walked into his villa in Tunis and killed him in front of his wife and children. And they took their revenge, not on the country, but on you. They put a bomb beneath your car in Vienna.
She was pulling harder at the tear in Shamron's coat. Gabriel took her hand.
It's all right, Gila. It was a long time ago.
Yes, but I remember it like it was only yesterday. I remember when the call came. Ari told me a bomb had gone off beneath a diplomat's car in Vienna. I remember going into the kitchen to make him some coffee and coming back to the bedroom to find him crying. He said, "It's all my fault. I killed his wife and child." It's the only time I've ever seen him cry. I didn't see him for a week. When he finally came home, I asked him what had happened. He wouldn't answer, of course. He'd regained his composure by then, but I know it's eaten away at him all these years. He blames himself for what happened.
He shouldn't, Gabriel said.
You weren't even allowed to grieve properly, were you? The government told the world that the wife and child of the Israeli diplomat were both dead. You buried your son in secret on the Mount of Olives. Just you, Ari, and the rabbi. And you hid your wife away in England under a false name. But Khaled found her. Khaled kidnapped your wife and used her to lure you to the Gare de Lyon.
A tear spilled down Gila's cheek. Gabriel brushed it away and found her wrinkled skin was still soft as velvet.
All because my husband came to see you one afternoon in September so long ago. You could have had such a different life. You could have been a great artist. Instead, we turned you into a killer. Why aren't you bitter, Gabriel? Why don't you hate Ari like his children do?
The course of my life was charted the day the Germans chose the little Austrian corporal to be their chancellor. Ari was just the helmsman on the night watch.
Are you that fatalistic?
Believe me, Gila,
I went through a period of time where I couldn't bear to look at Ari. But I've come to realize I'm more like him than I ever knew.
Maybe that's the quality he saw in your army fitness report.
Gabriel smiled briefly. Maybe it was. Gila fingered the tear in Shamron's jacket.
Do you know the story about how this happened?
It's one of the great mysteries inside the office, Gabriel said. There are all sorts of wild theories about how it happened, but he always refused to tell us the truth.
It was the night of the bombing in Vienna. Ari was in a hurry to get to Kingsall Boulevard. As he was climbing into his car, the coat got caught on the door, and he tore it.
She ran her finger along the wound.
I tried to fix it for him many times, but he would never let me. It was for Leia and Danny, he said. He's been wearing a ripped coat all these years because of what happened to your wife and son.
The telephone rang. Gabriel brought the receiver to his ear and listened in silence for a moment. I'll be right there, sir, he said a moment later, then rang off. That was the Prime Minister. He wants to see me right away. I'll come back when I'm finished.
Don't worry, Gabriel. Jonathan will be here soon.
I'll be back, Gila. His tone was too forceful. He kissed her cheek apologetically and stood. Gila seized his arm as he moved toward the door.
Take this, she said, holding out Shamron's coat. He would have wanted you to have it.
Don't talk like he's not going to make it.
Just take the jacket and go.
She gave him a bittersweet smile.
You mustn't keep the Prime Minister waiting.
Gabriel went into the corridor and hurried to the elevators. You mustn't keep the Prime Minister waiting. It was what Gila always said to Shamron whenever he left her. A car and security detail were waiting downstairs in the drive. It took them only 5 minutes to reach the Prime Minister's office at 3 Kaplan Street. The guards took Gabriel into the building through an underground entrance and shepherded him upstairs into the large, unexpectedly plain office on the top floor. The room was in semi-darkness. The Prime Minister was seated at his desk in a pool of light, dwarfed by the towering portrait of the Zionist leader Theodor Herzl that hung on the wall at his back. It had been more than a year since Gabriel had been in his presence. In that time, his hair had turned from silver to white, and his brown eyes had taken on the rheumy look of an old man. The meeting of the security cabinet had just broken up, and the Prime Minister was alone except for Amos Charette, the new Director General of the office, who was seated tensely in a leather armchair. Gabriel shook his hand for the first time.
It's a pleasure to finally meet you, Amos said. I wish the circumstances were different.
Gabriel sat down.
You're wearing Shamron's jacket, the Prime Minister said. Gila insisted I take it. It becomes you, he smiled distantly. You know, you're even beginning to look a little like him.
Is that supposed to be a compliment?
He was very handsome when he was a young man.
He was never young, Prime Minister.
None of us were. We were all old before our time. We gave up our youth to build this country. Shamron hasn't taken a day off since 1947, and this is how it ends?
The Prime Minister shook his head.
No, he'll live. Trust me, Gabriel. I've known him longer than even you.
Shamron is eternal, that's what Gila says.
Maybe not eternal, but he's not going to be killed by a bunch of terrorists.
The Prime Minister scowled at his wristwatch.
You had something you wanted to discuss with me, sir.
Your promotion to Chief of Special Ops.
I've agreed to take the position, sir.
I realize that, but perhaps now isn't the best time for you to be running the division.
May I ask why not?
Because all your attention needs to be focused on tracking down and punishing the men who did this to Shamron.
The Prime Minister lapsed into a sudden silence, as if giving Gabriel an opportunity to mount an objection. Gabriel sat motionless, his gaze downward toward his hands.
You surprise me, the Prime Minister said.
How so?
I was afraid you were going to tell me to find someone else.
One doesn't turn down the Prime Minister, sir.
But surely there's more to it than that.
I was in Rome when the terrorists attacked the Vatican, and I put Shamron in his car tonight. I heard the bomb go off.
He paused.
This network, whoever they are and whatever their goals, needs to be put out of business, and soon.
You sound as though you want vengeance.
Gabriel looked up from his hands.
I do, Prime Minister. Perhaps under those circumstances I'm the wrong man for the job.
Actually, under the circumstances, you are exactly the right man.
It was Amos who had spoken these words. Gabriel turned and regarded him carefully for the first time. He was a small, broad man, shaped like a square, with a monkish fringe of dark hair and a heavy brow. He still carried the rank of general in the IDF, but was dressed now in a pale gray suit. His candor was a refreshing change. Lev had been a dental probe of a man, forever prodding and searching for weakness and decay. Amos was more like a tack hammer. Gabriel would have to watch his step around him, lest the hammer fall on him.
Just make certain your anger doesn't cloud your judgment, Amos added.
It never has before, Gabriel said, holding Amos's dark gaze.
Amos gave him a humorless smile, as if to say, There'll be no shooting up French train stations on my watch, no matter what the circumstances. The Prime Minister leaned forward and braced himself on his elbows.
Do you believe Saudis are behind this?
We have some evidence that points to a Saudi connection to the Brotherhood of Allah, Gabriel said judiciously. But we'll need more intelligence before we start looking for a specific individual.
Ahmed bin Shafiq, for example.
Yes, Prime Minister.
And if it is him?
In my opinion, we're dealing with a network, not a movement. A network bought and paid for with Saudi money. If we lop off the head, the network will die. But it won't be easy, Prime Minister. We know very little about him. We don't even know what he really looks like. It will also be complicated politically because of the Americans.
It's not complicated at all. Ahmed bin Shafiq tried to kill my closest advisor, and so Ahmed bin Shafiq must die.
And if he's acting at the behest of Prince Nabil or someone in the royal family, a family with close historic and economic ties to our most important ally?
We'll know soon enough.
The Prime Minister gave a sideways glance at Amos.
Adrian Carter of the CIA would like a word with you.
I was supposed to go to Washington tomorrow to brief him on what we've learned about the attack on the Vatican.
Carter has requested a change of venue.
Where does he want to meet?
Amos answered him.
London? Why London? It was Carter's suggestion, Amos said. He wanted a convenient neutral location.
Since when is a CIA safe house in London neutral ground?
Gabriel looked at the Prime Minister, then Amos.
I don't want to leave Jerusalem, not until we know whether Shamron is going to live.
Carter says it's urgent, Amos said. He wants to see you tomorrow night.
Send someone else, then.
We can't, said the Prime Minister. You're the only one invited.
Chapter 11. London.
How's the old man? Asked Adrian Carter.
They were walking side by side in Eaton Place, sheltering from a thin night rain beneath Carter's umbrella. They had met 5 minutes earlier, as if by chance encounter, in Belgrave Square. Carter had been the one wearing the Macintosh raincoat and holding a copy of the Evening Standard. He was orthodox when it came to the conventions of tradecraft. According to the office wits at Langley, Adrian Carter left chalk marks on the bedpost when he wanted to make love to his wife.
Still unconscious, Gabriel replied. But he made it through the night, and he's not losing any more blood.
Is he going to make it?
Last night I would have said no.
And now?
I'm more worried about how he's going to come out of it. If he's left with brain damage or trapped in a body that won't obey his orders...
Gabriel's voice trailed off.
Shamron has only one thing in his life, and that's his work. If he can't work, he's going to be miserable. And so will everyone around him.
So, what else is new?
Carter glanced toward the doorway of the Georgian house at number 24.
The flat is in there. Let's take a walk around the block once, shall we? I like to do things by the book. Haven't you heard, Adrian? The Soviet Union collapsed a few years back. The KGB are out of business, You and the Russians are friends now.
One can never be too careful, Gabriel.
Didn't your security boys set up a surveillance detection run?
There are no boys, Gabriel.
Is that an agency safe flat?
Not exactly, Carter said. It belongs to a friend.
A friend of the agency?
A friend of the president, actually. Carter gave a gentle tug on Gabriel's coat sleeve and led him down the darkened street. They made a slow tour of Eaton Square, which was silent except for the grumble of the evening traffic on King's Road. Carter moved at a ponderous pace, like a man bound for an appointment he would rather not keep. Gabriel was wrestling with a single thought. Why did the deputy director for operations of the Central Intelligence Agency want to talk in a place where his own government wouldn't be listening? They made their way back to Eaton Place. This time Carter led Gabriel down the steps to the basement entrance. As Carter inserted the key into the lock, Gabriel quietly lifted the lid of the rubbish bin and saw it was empty. Carter opened the door and led them inside, into the sort of kitchen that real estate brochures routinely described as gourmet. The countertops were granite and agreeably lit by halogen lamps concealed beneath the custom cabinetry. The floor was covered in the Jerusalem limestone so admired by English and American sophisticates who wished to connect to their Mediterranean roots. Carter walked over to the stainless steel range and filled the electric tea kettle with bottled water. He didn't bother asking Gabriel whether he wanted something stronger. He knew Gabriel drank nothing but the occasional glass of wine, and never mixed alcohol with business except for reasons of cover.
"It's a maisonette," Carter said. "The drawing room's upstairs. Go make yourself comfortable." "Are you giving me permission to have a look around, Adrian?"
Carter was now opening and closing the cabinet doors with a befuddled expression on his face. Gabriel walked over to the pantry, found a box of Earl Grey tea, and tossed it to Carter before heading upstairs. The drawing room was comfortably furnished, but with an air of anonymity common in a pied-à-terre. It seemed to Gabriel that no one had ever loved or quarreled or grieved here. He picked up a framed photograph from a side table and saw a bluff, prosperous American with three well-fed children and a wife who'd had too much cosmetic surgery. Two more photographs showed the American standing stiffly at the side of the president. Both were signed, "To Bill with Gratitude." Carter came upstairs a moment later, a tea tray balanced between his hands. He had a head of thinning curly hair and the sort of broad mustache once worn by American college professors. Little about Carter's demeanor suggested he was one of the most powerful members of Washington's vast intelligence establishment, or that before his ascension to the rarefied atmosphere of Langley's seventh floor, he had been a field man of the highest reputation. Carter's natural inclination to listen rather than speak led most to conclude he was a therapist of some sort. When one thought of Adrian Carter, one pictured a man enduring confessions of affairs and inadequacies, or a Dickensian figure hunched over thick books with long Latin words. People tended to underestimate Carter. It was one of his most potent weapons.
"Who's behind it, Adrian?" Gabriel asked.
"You tell me, Gabriel." Carter placed the tea tray on the center table and removed his raincoat as if weary from too much travel.
"It's your neighborhood."
"It's our neighborhood, but something tells me it's your problem. Otherwise you wouldn't be here in London." Gabriel looked around the room. "In a borrowed safe flat with no microphones and no backup from the local station."
"You don't miss much, do you? Humor me, Gabriel. Tell me his name."
"He's a former Saudi GID agent named Ahmed bin Shafiq."
"Bravo, Gabriel. Well done."
Carter threw his coat over the back of a chair.
"Well done indeed."
Carter lifted the lid of the teapot, savored the aroma, and decided it needed to steep a moment longer.
"How did you know?"
"We didn't know," Gabriel said. "It was an educated guess, based on a few threads of evidence."
"Such as?"
Gabriel told Carter everything he knew. The blown operation against Professor Ali Massoudi. The surveillance photos and Zurich bank account information found on Massoudi's computer. The links between Ibrahim El-Banna and the Saudi agent who called himself Khalil. The reports of a Saudi by the same name trolling the refugee camps of southern Lebanon for recruits. All the while Carter was fussing with the tea.
He poured the first cup and handed it to Gabriel Plain. His own required more elaborate preparation. A careful measure of milk, then the tea, then a lump of sugar. Interrogators referred to such obvious playing for time as displacement activity. Carter was a pipe smoker. Gabriel feared it would make an appearance soon.
"And what about you?" Gabriel asked. "When did you know it was Bin Shafiq?"
Carter snared a second lump with the tongs and briefly debated adding it to the cup before plopping it unceremoniously back into the bowl.
"Maybe I knew the day we asked His Majesty to shut down Group 205," he said. "Or maybe it was the day Bin Shafiq seemed to vanish from the face of the earth. You see, Gabriel, if there's one thing I've learned in this business, it's that for every action we take, there's bound to be a negative reaction. We drove the Russian bear out of Afghanistan and created a hydra in the process. We smashed the corporate headquarters of Al-Qaeda, and now the branch offices are running their own affairs. We shut down Bin Shafiq's shop inside the GID, and now it seems Bin Shafiq has gone into private practice.
Why?
You're asking what drove him over the edge?"
Carter shrugged and stirred his tea mournfully.
"It didn't take much. Ahmed Bin Shafiq is a true Wahhabi believer. Grandson of an Ikhwan warrior," said Gabriel, which earned him an admiring nod from Carter.
"One may argue about why the Saudis support terrorism," Carter said. "One may have a learned debate as to whether they truly support the goals of the murderers they arm and finance, or whether they are engaged in a clever and cynical policy to control the environment around them and thus ensure their own survival. One may not have such a debate about the man the GID chose to carry out that policy. Ahmed Bin Shafiq is a believer. Ahmed Bin Shafiq hates the United States, the West, and Christianity, and he would be much happier if your country no longer existed. It was why we insisted that His Majesty shut down his little shop of terror."
"So when you forced the king to shut down Group 205, Bin Shafiq snapped. He decided to use all the contacts he'd made over the years and launch a wave of terrorism of his own? Surely there's more to it than that, Adrian."
"I'm afraid we may have given him a little shove," Carter said. "We invaded Iraq against the wishes of the kingdom and most of its inhabitants. We've kept captured members of Al-Qaeda locked away in secret prisons where they belong. This doesn't look good to the Muslim world, and it adds fuel to the fires of jihad. You've had a hand in it as well. The Saudis see your separation fence for what it is, a unilateral final border. They're not pleased with it."
"This might come as a shock to you, Adrian, but we don't care what the Saudis think of our fence. If they hadn't poured millions into the coffers of Hamas and Islamic Jihad, we wouldn't need one."
"Back to my original point," said Carter, pausing for a moment to sip his tea. "The Islamic world is seething with anger, and Ahmed Bin Shafiq, true Wahhabi believer, has stepped forward to raise the flag of jihad against the infidel. He's used his contacts from his Group 205 days to construct a new network. He's doing what Bin Laden is no longer capable of doing, which is plan and carry out large-scale terror spectaculars like the attack on the Vatican. His network is small, extremely professional, and, as he has proven conclusively, very lethal.
And it's bought and paid for with Saudi money."
"Most definitely," said Carter.
"How high does it go, Adrian?"
"Very high," said Carter. "Damn near to the top."
"Where's he operating? Who's footing the bill? Where's the money coming from?"
"AAB Holdings of Riyadh, Geneva and points in between," said Carter unequivocally. "Ahmed Bin Shafiq is one of AAB's most successful investments. Can I freshen up your tea?"
There was another break in the proceedings, this time while Carter tried to divine how to light the gas fire. He stood mystified before the grate for a moment, then, with a glance toward Gabriel, appealed for assistance. Gabriel found a key on the mantel, used it to start the flow of gas, then ignited it with an ornamental match.
"How many years do you give them, Gabriel? How long before the House of Saud collapses and the Islamic Republic of Arabia rises in its place? 5 years? 10? Or is it more like 20? We've never really been good about making predictions like that. We thought the Soviet Empire would last forever. And we thought Hamas could never win an election."
Carter chuckled mirthlessly.
"Our best minds give them 7 years at the most. His Majesty is prepared to spend that 7 years playing the game by the old rules.
provide cheap oil and pseudo-friendship to us, while at the same time paying lip service to the forces of Islam and bribing them not to attack him. And when it's over, he'll flee to his string of palaces along the Riviera and live out the rest of his days in luxury that is too grotesque even to contemplate, hopefully with his head still attached to his body. Carter lifted his palms toward the fire.
"It's not hot," he said. "The logs are made of ceramic. Give it a minute to heat up."
Carter appeared incredulous. Gabriel drifted over to the window and peered into the street as a car rolled slowly past and vanished around the next corner. Carter gave up on the fire and returned to his seat.
"And then there are those in the royal family who are willing to play the game by a different set of rules. We'll call them the true believers. They think the only way the Al-Saud can survive is to renew the covenant they formed with Muhammad Abdul Wahhab 2 centuries ago in the Najd. But this new covenant has to take into account new realities. The monster that the Al-Saud created 200 years ago now holds all the cards. And the true believers are prepared to give the monster what it wants. Infidel blood. Jihad without end. Some of these true believers want to go further. The expulsion of all infidels from the peninsula. An embargo on oil sales to America and any other country that does business with yours. They believe oil should no longer be treated as simply an unending pool of liquid money that flows from the terminals of Ras Tanura into the Zurich bank accounts of the Al-Saud. They want to use it as a weapon that could be used to cripple the American economy and make the Wahhabis masters of the planet, just as Allah intended when he placed that sea of oil beneath the sands of the Al-Hasa. And some of these true believers, such as the chairman and CEO of AAB Holdings of Riyadh, Geneva, and points in between, are actually willing to shed a little infidel blood themselves.
You're referring to Abdul Aziz al-Bakri.
I am indeed, said Carter.
Know much about him?
Plenty. Humor me. At last accounting, he was something like the 15th richest man in the world, with a personal fortune in the vicinity of $10 billion. Give or take a billion or two. He's the president, chairman, and Lord High Emperor of AAB Holdings of Riyadh, Geneva, and points in between. A for Abdul, A for Aziz, and B for al-Bakri. AAB owns banks and investment houses. AAB does shipping and steel. AAB is cutting down the forests of the Amazon and strip mining the Andes of Peru and Bolivia. AAB has a Belgian chemical company and a Dutch pharmaceutical. AAB's real estate and development division is one of the world's largest. Abdul Aziz al-Bakri owns more hotels than anyone else in the world.
Carter picked up where Gabriel left off. He has a palace in Riyadh he rarely visits, and 2 former wives there he never sees. He owns a mansion on the Ile de la Cité in Paris, a princely estate in the English countryside, a townhouse in Mayfair, oceanfront villas in Saint-Tropez, Marbella, and Maui, ski chalets in Zermatt and Aspen, a Park Avenue apartment recently appraised at $40 million, and a sprawling compound overlooking the Potomac that I pass every day on the way to work. Carter seemed to find the mansion on the Potomac the most grievous of al-Bakri's sins. Carter's father had been an Episcopal minister from New Hampshire, and beneath his placid exterior beat the heart of a Puritan. Al-Bakri and his entourage traveled the world in a gold-plated 747, he continued. Twice a year, once in February and again in August, AAB's operations go seaborne when al-Bakri and his entourage set up shop aboard Alexandra, his 300-foot yacht. Have I forgotten anything?
His friends call him Zizi, Gabriel replied. He has one of the world's largest private collections of French Impressionist art, and we've been telling you for years that he's up to his eyeballs in funding terrorism, especially against us.
I didn't realize that.
Realize what?
That Zizi is a collector.
A very aggressive one, actually.
Ever had the pleasure of meeting him?
I'm afraid Zizi and I are at different ends of the trade.
Gabriel frowned.
So what's the connection between Zizi al-Bakri and Ahmed bin Shafiq?
Carter blew thoughtfully on his tea, a sign that he was not yet ready to answer Gabriel's question.
An interesting fellow, al-Bakri. Did you know that his father was Ibn Saud's personal banker? As you might expect, Papa al-Bakri did quite well.
well enough to give his son $10 million to start his own company. That was nothing compared to the seed money he got from the Al Saud when things started to take off. $100 million, if the rumor mill is to be believed. AAB is still a favorite dumping ground for Saudi royal cash, which is one of the reasons why Zizi is so interested in making sure the House of Saud survives. Gabriel's heart sank as Carter reached for the pouch. "He's among the world's richest men," Carter said, "and one of the world's most charitable. He's built mosques and Islamic centers all across Europe. He's financed development projects in the Nile Delta and famine relief in Sudan. He's given millions to the Palestinian refugees and millions more to development projects in the West Bank and Gaza. And more than $30 million to that Saudi telethon to raise money for suicide bombers," Gabriel added. "Zizi was the largest single donor. Now answer my question, Adrian." "Which question is that?" "What's the connection between Zizi and Bin Shafiq?" "Your quick study, Gabriel. You tell me." "Obviously, Zizi is bankrolling Bin Shafiq's network." "Obviously," said Carter in agreement. "But Bin Shafiq is a Saudi. He can get money anywhere. Zizi has something more valuable than money. Zizi has a global infrastructure through which Bin Shafiq can move men and materiel. And Zizi has a perfect place for a mastermind like Bin Shafiq to hide. AAB holdings of Riyadh, Geneva, and points in between." A silence fell between them like a curtain, while Carter drowsily loaded his pipe. Gabriel was still standing in the window, peering into the street. He was tempted to remain there, for Carter's tobacco, when ignited, smelled like a combination of burning hay and wet dog. He knew, however, that the conversation had passed the point where it might be conducted in front of an insecure window. Reluctantly, he lowered himself into the chair opposite Carter, and they gazed at each other in silence, Carter puffing contemplatively and Gabriel wearily waving the smoke from his eyes. "How sure are you?"
"Very."
"How do you know?"
"Sources and methods," said Carter mechanically.
"Sources and methods."
"How do you know, Adrian?"
"Because we listened to him," Carter said. "The National Security Agency is a wonderful thing. We also have sources inside the moderate wing of the House of Saud and the GID who are willing to tell us things. Ahmed Bin Shafiq is living largely in the West under an assumed identity. He is buried somewhere within Zizi's financial empire, and the two of them confer on a regular basis. Of this we are certain."
There was a manila file folder on the center table next to Carter's tea tray. Inside was a single photograph, which Carter handed to Gabriel. It showed a man in a woolen overcoat and trilby hat standing at a wrought iron gate. The face was in left profile, and the features were somewhat gauzy. Judging from the compression of the image, the photograph had been snapped from some distance.
"Is this him?"
"We think so," Carter replied.
"Where was it taken?"
"Outside Zizi's house on the Ile de la Cité in Paris. The cameraman was on the other side of the Seine on the Quai de l'Hôtel de Ville, which accounts for a certain lack of clarity of the image."
"How long ago?"
"6 months."
Carter rose slowly to his feet and wandered over to the fireplace. He was about to rap his pipe against the grate when Gabriel reminded him that it was a fake. He sat down again and emptied the pipe into a large cut-glass ashtray.
"How many Americans were killed at the Vatican?" Gabriel asked.
28, including a curial bishop."
"How much money has Zizi al-Bakri given to the terrorists over the years?"
"Hundreds of millions."
"Go after him," Gabriel said.
"Make a case against him and put him on trial."
"Against Zizi al-Bakri?"
"Section 18, USC 2339B. Have you ever heard of it, Adrian?"
"You're quoting American law to me now?"
"It's a violation of American law to give money to designated terrorist groups, regardless of whether the money was used for specific attacks. You could have probably prosecuted dozens of wealthy Saudis for giving material support to your enemies, including Zizi al-Bakri."
"You disappoint me, Gabriel. I always thought of you as a fairly reasonable fellow, a bit too concerned with questions of right and wrong at times, but reasonable. We can't go after Zizi al-Bakri."
"Why?"
"Money," said Carter. Then he added, "and oil, of course."
Of course.
Carter toyed with his lighter. The Saudi royal family has a lot of friends in Washington. The kind of friends only money can buy. Zizi has friends as well. He's endowed academic chairs and filled them with associates and supporters. He's underwritten the creation of Arab studies departments at a half dozen major American universities. He's almost single-handedly financed a major renovation of the Kennedy Center. He gives to the pet charitable projects of influential senators and invests in the business ventures of their friends and relatives. He owns a chunk of one of our most prominent banks and bits and pieces of several other prominent American companies. He's also served as a middleman on countless Saudi-American business deals. Is the picture becoming clear to you now? It was, but Gabriel wanted to hear more. If Zizi's battalion of Washington lawyers even suspected he was the target of a criminal probe, Zizi would call His Majesty, and he would call Ambassador Bashir, and Ambassador Bashir would pop over to the White House for a little chat with the President. He would remind the President that a twist or two on the oil spigots would send the price of gasoline over $5 a gallon. He might even point out that a price spike of that magnitude would surely hurt people in the heartland, who tend to drive long distances, and who also tend to vote for the President's party. So Zizi gets away with murder, literally. I'm afraid so. Ask not about things which, if made plain to you, may cause you trouble. You know your Quran, Carter said. One of the reasons you can't operate against Zizi or prosecute him is because you're afraid of what you might find. Business entanglements with prominent Americans, shady dealings with Washington insiders. Imagine the reaction of the American people if they learned that a Saudi billionaire with business ties to prominent figures in Washington is actually financing the activities of your enemies. The relationship barely survived one 9/11. I doubt it would survive a second. No, it wouldn't, at least not in its present form. There's already a movement on Capitol Hill to isolate Saudi Arabia because of its support of the global Islamic extremism. A scandal involving Zizi al-Bakri would only add fuel to the fire. Several foreign policy lights in Congress are considering legislation that would put the screws to Saudi Arabia. They have that luxury. They won't take the fall if the American economy goes into the toilet because of higher fuel prices. The President will. So what do you want from us, Adrian? What do you wish to say to me in this room where no one is listening? The President of the United States would like a favor, Carter said, gazing into the fire. The sort of favor you happen to be very good at. He'd like you to run an agent into the house of Zizi. He'd like you to find out who's coming and going. And if Ahmed bin Shafiq happens to walk by, he'd like you to take a shot at him. It will be your operation, but we'll give you whatever support you need. We'll be over the horizon, so far over to make certain that we can maintain plausible deniability in Riyadh. You disappoint me, Adrian. I always thought of you as a reasonable fellow. What have I done now? I thought you were going to ask me to kill Zizi al-Bakri and be done with it. Kill Zizi? Carter shook his head. Zizi is untouchable. Zizi is radioactive. Gabriel returned to his outpost by the window and peered into the street as a pair of lovers hurried along the pavement through the swirling rain. We're not contract killers, he said. We can't be hired to do dirty jobs you can't do yourself. You want bin Shafiq dead, but you're not willing to risk the fallout. You're setting us up to take the fall. I could remind you of a few salient facts, said Carter. I could remind you that this president has remained steadfastly at your side while the rest of the world has treated you as the Jew among nations. I could remind you that he allowed you to build the separation fence while the rest of the world accused you of behaving like South Africans. I could remind you that he allowed you to lock Arafat away in the Mukata while the rest of the world accused you of behaving like Nazi stormtroopers. I could remind you of the many other times this president has carried your dirty water, but I won't, because that would be impolitic. It would also suggest that this request is a quid pro quo of some sort, which it most certainly is not. Then what is it? A recognition, said Carter. A recognition that we Americans don't have the stomach or the backbone to do the things we have to do to win this fight. Our fingers have been burned, our image has taken a terrible beating. We've taken a look in the mirror, and we don't like what we see. Our politicians would like us to make reservations on the first flight out of Iraq so they can start spending money on the sorts of things that win votes. Our people want to go back to their fat, happy lives. They want to bury their heads in the sand and pretend that there really isn't an organized force in their world that is actively plotting and planning their destruction. We've paid a terrible price for climbing into the gutter with the terrorists and fighting them on their level, but I'm sure you always knew we would. No one's paid a higher price than you. So you want us to do it for you? I suppose that's what they call outsourcing. How American of you, Adrian. Under the current circumstances, the United States cannot target a former high-ranking Saudi intelligence officer for assassination, because to do so would shatter our relationship with Riyadh. Nor can we arrest and prosecute Zizi al-Bakri for the reasons I've given you. So you want the problem to go away? Precisely. Sweep it under the rug. Postpone the reckoning until a more convenient date. In so many words. You think this is the way to defeat your Hydra? Chop off a head and hope for the best. You have to burn out the roots, the way Hercules did. You have to attack the beast with arrows dipped in gall. You want to take on the House of Saud? Not just the House of Saud, Gabriel said. The Wahhabi fanatics, with whom they made a covenant of blood 200 years ago on the barren plateau of Najd. They're your real enemy, Adrian. They're the ones who created Hydra in the first place. A wise prince chooses the time and place of the battle, and this is not the time to tear down the House of Saud. Gabriel lapsed into a moody silence. Carter was peering into the bowl of his pipe and making minor adjustments in the disposition of his tobacco, like an Oxford don waiting for an answer from a dull student. Do I need to remind you that they targeted Shamron? Gabriel gave Carter a dark look that said he most certainly did not. Then why the hesitation? I would have thought you'd be straining at the leash to get Bin Shafiq after what he did to the old man. I want him more than anyone, Adrian. But I never strain at the leash. This is a dangerous operation, too dangerous for you even to attempt. If something goes wrong, or if we're caught in the act, it will end badly for all three of us. Three? You, me, and the President. So obey Shamron's 11th commandment and you'll be fine. Thou shalt not get caught. Bin Shafiq is a ghost. We don't even have a picture. That's not entirely true. Carter reached into his manila file folder again and came out with another photograph, which he dropped onto the coffee table for Gabriel to see. It showed a man with narrow black eyes, his face partially concealed by a keffiyeh. That's Bin Shafiq almost 20 years ago in Afghanistan. He was our friend then. We were on the same side. We supplied the weapons. Bin Shafiq and his masters in Riyadh supplied the money. And the Wahhabi ideology that helped give birth to the Taliban, Gabriel said. No good deed goes unpunished, said Carter contritely. But we have something more valuable than a 20-year-old photograph. We have his voice. Carter picked up a small black remote, aimed it at a Bose Wave radio, and pressed the play button. A moment later, two men began to converse in English, one with the accent of an American, the other of an Arab. I take it the Saudi is Bin Shafiq. Carter nodded. When was it recorded? In 1988, Carter said, in a safe house in Peshawar. Who's the American? Gabriel asked, though he knew the answer already. Carter hit the stop button and looked into the fire. Me, he said distantly. The American at the CIA safe house in Peshawar was me. Would you recognize Bin Shafiq if you saw him again? I might. But our sources tell us he had several rounds of plastic surgery before going operational. I would recognize the scar on his right forearm, though. He got hit by a piece of shrapnel during a trip to Afghanistan in 1985. The scar runs from just above the wrist to just below the elbow. No plastic surgeon could have done anything about that. Inside the arm or outside? Inside, Carter said. The injury left him with a bit of a withered hand. He had several operations to try to repair it, but nothing ever worked. He tends to keep it in his pocket. He doesn't like to shake hands. He's a proud Bedouin, Bin Shafiq. He doesn't respect physical infirmity. I don't suppose your sources in Riyadh can tell us where he's hiding within Zizi's empire,
Unfortunately, they can't, but we know he's there. Put an agent into the house of Zizi, and eventually Bin Shafiq will walk through the back door. Put an agent close to Zizi al-Bakri. How do you propose we do that, Adrian? Zizi has more security than most heads of state. I wouldn't dream of interfering in matters operational, Carter said. But rest assured that we're willing to be patient and that we intend to see it through to the end. Patience and follow-through aren't typical American virtues. You like to make a mess and move on to the next problem. There was another long silence, broken this time by the clatter of Carter's pipe against the rim of the ashtray. What do you want, Gabriel? Guarantees. There are no guarantees in our business, you know that. I want everything you have on Bin Shafiq and al-Bakri. Within reason, Carter said. I'm not going to give you a dump truck worth of dirt on prominent figures in Washington. I want protection, Gabriel said. When this thing goes down, we'll be the number one suspect. We always are, even when we're not responsible. We're going to need your help weathering the storm. I can speak only for the D.O., said Carter, and I can assure you we'll be there for you. We take out Bin Shafiq at the time and place of our choosing, with no interference from Langley. The President would be grateful if you could avoid doing it on American soil. There are no guarantees in our business, Adrian. Touché. You might find this hard to believe, but I can't make this decision on my own. I need to speak to Amos and the Prime Minister. Amos and the Prime Minister will do what you tell them. Within reason. So what are you going to tell them? That the American President needs a favor, Gabriel said. And I want to help him. Chapter 12. Tel Megiddo, Israel. The Prime Minister granted Gabriel his operational charter at 2:30 the following afternoon. Gabriel headed straight for Armageddon. He reckoned it was a fine place to start. The weather seemed perversely glorious for such an occasion. Cool temperatures, a pale blue sky, a soft Judean breeze that plucked at his shirt sleeve as he sped along the Jaffa Road. He switched on the radio. The mournful music that had saturated the airwaves in the hours after the attempt on Shamron's life was now gone. A news bulletin came suddenly on the air. The Prime Minister had promised to do everything in his power to track down and punish those responsible for the attempt on Shamron's life. He made no mention of the fact that he already knew who was responsible, or that he had granted Gabriel the authority to kill him. Gabriel plunged down the Babel Wad toward the sea, weaving impatiently through the slower traffic, then raced the setting sun northward along the coastal plain. There was a security alert near Hadera, according to the radio. A suspected suicide bomber had managed to slip through a crossing in the separation fence near Tulkarm, and Gabriel was forced to wait by the side of the road for 20 minutes before heading into the valley of Jezreel. 5 miles from Afula, a rounded hillock appeared on his left. In Hebrew, it was known as Tel Megiddo, or the Mound of Megiddo. The rest of the world knew it as Armageddon, forecast in the Book of Revelation to be the site of the final earthly confrontation between the forces of good and evil. The battle had not yet begun, and the parking lot was empty except for a trio of dusty pickup trucks, a sign that the archaeological team was still at work. Gabriel climbed out of his car and headed up the steep footpath to the summit. Tel Megiddo had been under periodic archaeological excavation for more than a century, and the top of the hill was cut by a maze of long, narrow trenches. Evidence of more than 20 cities had been discovered beneath the soil atop the tell, including one believed to have been built by King Solomon. He stopped at the edge of a trench and peered down. Crouched on all fours was a small figure in a tan bush jacket, picking at the soil with a hand trowel. Gabriel thought of the last time he had stood over a man in an excavation pit, and felt as though a lump of ice had been placed suddenly at the back of his neck. The archaeologist looked up and regarded him with a pair of clever brown eyes, then looked down again and resumed his work.
"I've been waiting for you," said Ellie Lavone. "What took you so long?"
Gabriel sat in the dirt at the edge of the pit and watched Lavone work. They had known each other since the Black September operation. Ellie Lavone had been an Ayan, a tracker. His job was to follow the terrorists and learn their habits. In many respects, his assignment had been more dangerous even than Gabriel's, for Lavon had sometimes been exposed to the terrorist for days and weeks on end with no backup. After the unit was disbanded, he'd settled in Vienna and opened a small investigative bureau called Wartime Claims and Inquiries. Operating on a shoestring budget, he had managed to track down millions of dollars worth of looted Jewish assets and had played a significant role in prying a multi-billion dollar settlement from the banks of Switzerland. These days, Lavon was working the dig at Megiddo and teaching archaeology part-time at Hebrew University.
What have you got there, Ellie?
A piece of pottery, I suspect.
A gust of wind took his wispy, unkempt hair and blew it across his forehead.
What about you?
A Saudi billionaire who's trying to destroy the civilized world.
Haven't they already done that?
Gabriel smiled.
I need you, Ellie. You know how to read balance sheets. You know how to follow the trail of money without anyone else knowing it.
Who's the Saudi?
The chairman and CEO of Jihad Incorporated.
Does the chairman have a name?
Abdulaziz al-Bakri.
Zizi al-Bakri?
One and the same.
I suppose this has something to do with Shamron.
And the Vatican.
What's Zizi's connection?
Gabriel told him.
I guess I don't need to ask what you intend to do with Bin Shafiq, Lavon said.
Zizi's business empire is enormous. Bin Shafiq could be operating from anywhere in the world. How are we going to find him?
We're going to put an agent into Zizi's inner circle and wait for Bin Shafiq to walk into it.
An agent in Zizi's camp?
Lavon shook his head.
Can't be done.
Yes, it can.
How?
I'm going to find something Zizi wants, Gabriel said. Then I'm going to give it to him.
I'm listening.
Gabriel sat down at the edge of the excavation trench with his legs dangling over the side and told Lavon how he planned to penetrate Jihad Incorporated. Lavon kept working. From the bottom of the trench came the sound of his work. Pick, pick, brush, brush, blow.
Who's the agent?
He asked when Gabriel had finished.
I don't have one yet.
Lavon was silent for a moment. Pick, pick, brush, brush, blow.
What do you want from me?
Turn Zizi al-Bakri and the AAB Holdings inside out. I want a complete breakdown of every company he owns or controls. Profiles of all his top executives and the members of his personal entourage. I want to know how each person got there and how they've stayed. I want to know more about Zizi than Zizi knows about himself.
And what happens when we go operational?
You'll go too.
I'm too old and tired for any rough stuff.
You're the greatest surveillance artist in the history of the office, Ellie. I can't do this without you.
Lavon sat up and brushed his hands on his trousers.
Run an agent into Zizi al-Bakri's inner circle. Madness.
He tossed Gabriel a hand trowel.
Get down here and help me. We're losing the light.
Gabriel climbed down into the pit and knelt beside his old friend. Together they scratched at the ancient soil until night fell like a curtain over the valley. It was after 9 o'clock by the time they arrived at King Saul Boulevard. Lavon was long retired from the office but still gave the odd lecture at the academy and still had credentials to enter the building whenever he pleased. Gabriel cleared him into the file rooms of the research division, then headed down to a gloomy corridor 2 levels below ground. At the end of the hall was room 456C. Affixed to the door was a paper sign written in Gabriel's own stylish Hebrew hand that read, Temporary Committee for the Study of Terror Threats in Western Europe. He decided to leave it for now. He opened the combination lock, switched on the lights, and went inside. The room seemed frozen in time. They'd had several names for it, the pod, the quad, the tank. Yakov, a pockmarked tough from the Arab Affairs Department of Shabak, had christened it the Hellhole. Yossi from Research had called it the Village of the Damned, but then Yossi had read classics at Oxford and always brought an air of erudition to his work, even when the subjects weren't worthy of it. Gabriel paused at the trestle table that Dina and Ramona had shared. Their constant squabbling over territory had driven him to near madness. The separation line he had drawn down the center of the table was still there, along with the warning Ramona had written on her side of the border. cross at your own risk. Ramona was a captain in the IDF and worked for Amman, military intelligence. She was also Gila Shamron's niece. She believed in defensible borders and had responded with retaliatory raids each time Dina had strayed over the line. At Dina's place, now, was the short note she had left there on the final day of the operation. May we never have to return here again. How naive, thought Gabriel. Dina, of all people, should have known better. He continued his slow tour of the room. In the corner stood the same pile of outmoded computer equipment that no one had ever bothered to remove. Before becoming the headquarters of Group Haled, room 456C had been nothing more than a dumping ground for old furniture and obsolete electronics, often used by the members of the night staff as a spot for romantic trysts. Gabriel's chalkboard was still there, too. He could scarcely decipher the last words he had written. He gazed up at the walls, which were covered with photographs of young Palestinian men. One photograph seized his attention, a boy with a beret on his head and a keffiyeh draped over his shoulders, seated on the lap of Yasser Arafat, Khaled al-Khalifa, at the funeral of his father, Sabri. Gabriel had killed Sabri, and he had killed Khaled as well. He cleared the walls of the old photographs and put two new ones in their place. One showed a man in a keffiyeh in the mountains of Afghanistan. The other showed the same man in a cashmere overcoat and trilby hat standing before a billionaire's home in Paris. Group Khaled was now Group Bin Shafiq. For the first 48 hours, Gabriel and Lavon worked alone. On the third day, they were joined by Yossi, a tall, balding man with the bearing of an English intellectual. Ramona came on the fourth day, as did Yaakov, who arrived from Shabak headquarters, carrying a box filled with material on the terrorists who had attacked Shamron's car on the Jaffa Road. Dina was the last to arrive. Small and dark-haired, she had been standing in Tel Aviv's Dizengoff Street on October 19, 1994, when a Hamas suicide bomber had turned the No. 5 bus into a coffin for 21 people. Her mother and two of her sisters were among those killed. Dina had been seriously wounded and now walked with a slight limp. She had dealt with the loss by becoming an expert in terrorism. Indeed, Dina Sarid could recite the time, place, and butcher's bill of every act of terror ever committed against the State of Israel. She had once told Gabriel she knew more about the terrorists than they knew about themselves. Gabriel had believed her. They divided into the areas of responsibility. Ahmed bin Shafiq and the Brotherhood of Allah became the province of Dina, Yaakov, and Ramona, while Yossi joined Lavon's excavation of AAB Holdings. Gabriel, at least for the moment, worked largely alone, for he had given himself the unenviable task of attempting to identify every painting ever acquired or sold by Zizi al-Bakri. As the days wore on, the walls of room 456C began to reflect the operation's unique nature. Upon one wall, slowly appeared the murky outlines of a lethal new terrorist network led by a man who was largely a ghost. To the best of their ability, they retraced Bin Shafiq's long journey through the bloodstream of Islamic extremism. Wherever there had been trouble, it seemed, there had been Bin Shafiq, handing out Saudi oil money and Wahhabi propaganda by the fistful. Afghanistan, Lebanon, Egypt, Algeria, Jordan, Pakistan, Chechnya, Bosnia, and of course the Palestinian Authority. They were not without significant leads, however, because in carrying out two major attacks, Bin Shafiq and the Brotherhood had surrendered more than a dozen names that could be investigated for connections and associations. And then there was Ibrahim el-Banna, the Egyptian Imam of Death, and Professor Ali Massoudi, the recruiter and talent spotter. On the opposite wall there appeared another network, AAB Holdings of Riyadh, Geneva, and points in between. Using open sources, and some that were not so open, Lavon painstakingly sifted through the layers of Zizi's financial empire and assembled the disparate pieces like bits of an ancient artifact. At the top of the structure was AAB itself. Beneath it was an intricate financial web of subholding companies and corporate shells that allowed Zizi to extend his influence to nearly every corner of the globe under conditions of near-perfect corporate secrecy. With most of his companies registered in Switzerland and the Cayman Islands, Lavon likened Zizi to a financial stealth fighter, capable of striking at will while avoiding detection by enemy radar. Despite the opaque nature of Zizi's empire, Lavone came to the conclusion the numbers didn't add up.
Zizi couldn't possibly have earned enough from his early investments to justify the size of his later acquisitions, he explained to Gabriel. AAB Holdings is a front for the House of Saud.
As for trying to find Ahmed bin Shafiq anywhere within Zizi's financial octopus, Lavone likened it to finding a needle in the Arabian desert.
Not impossible, he said, but you're likely to die of thirst trying.
Yossi saw to Zizi's personnel. He focused on the relatively small team that worked inside Zizi's Geneva headquarters, along with companies wholly owned or controlled by AAB. Most of his time, though, was devoted to Zizi's large personal entourage. Their photographs soon covered the wall above Yossi's workplace and stood in stark contrast to those of Bin Shafiq's terror network. New photographs arrived each day as Yossi monitored Zizi's frenetic movements around the globe. Zizi arriving for a meeting in London, Zizi consulting with German automakers in Stuttgart, Zizi enjoying the view of the Red Sea from his new hotel in Sharm el-Sheikh, Zizi conferring with the King of Jordan about a possible construction deal, Zizi opening a desalination plant in Yemen, Zizi collecting a humanitarian award from an Islamic group in Montreal whose website, Yossi pointed out, contained an open call for the destruction of the State of Israel. As for Gabriel's corner of the room, it was a sanctuary from the realms of terror and finance. His wall was covered not with the faces of terrorists or business executives, but with dozens of photographs of French Impressionist prints. And while Lavone and Yossi spent their days digging through dreary ledger sheets and computer printouts, Gabriel could often be seen leafing through old catalogs, Impressionist monographs, and press clippings describing Zizi's exploits on the world art scene. By the end of the 10th day, Gabriel had decided how he was going to slip an agent into Jihad Incorporated. He walked over to Yossi's collage of photographs and gazed at a single image. It showed a gaunt, gray-haired Englishman, seated next to Zizi 6 months earlier at the Impressionist and Modern Art auction at Christie's in New York. Gabriel removed the photograph and held it up for the others to see.
"This man," he said. "He has to go."
Then he called Adrian Carter on a private secure number at Langley and told him how he planned to penetrate the house of Zizi.
"All you need now is a painting and a girl,"
Carter said.
"You find the painting, I'll get you the girl."
Gabriel left King Saul Boulevard a little earlier than usual and drove to Ain Karim. There were still security guards posted outside the intensive care unit of the Hadassah Medical Center, but Shamron was alone when Gabriel entered his room.
"Prodigal son has decided to pay me a visit," he said bitterly. "It's a good thing we're a desert people. Otherwise, you would put me on an ice floe and cast me out to sea."
Gabriel sat down next to the bed.
"I've been here at least a half dozen times."
"When?"
"Late at night when you're asleep."
"You hover over me, like Gila and the doctors. Why can't you come during the day like a normal person?"
"I've been busy."
"The Prime Minister isn't too busy to come see me at the reasonable hour."
Shamron, his injured neck immobilized by a heavy plastic brace, gave Gabriel a vindictive sideways glance.
"He told me he's allowing Amos to find his own man for special ops so that you can run this fool's errand for Adrian Carter and the Americans."
"I take it you disapprove."
"Vehemently."
Shamron closed his eyes for a long moment, long enough for Gabriel to cast a nervous glance at the bank of monitors next to his bed.
"Blue and white," he said finally. "We do things for ourselves. We don't ask others for help, and we don't help others with problems of their own making. We certainly don't volunteer to serve as a patsy for Adrian Carter."
"You're in this hospital bed instead of at your desk in the Prime Minister's office. That makes Zizi al-Bakri and Ahmed bin Shafiq my problem, too. Besides, the world has changed, Ari. We need to work together to survive. The old rules don't apply."
Shamron lifted his heavily veined hand and pointed toward the plastic water cup on his bedside table.
Gabriel held it to Shamron's lips while he sipped water through the straw.
At whose request are you undertaking this errand? Shamron asked. Is it Adrian Carter or higher up the chain of command?
Greeted by Gabriel's silence, Shamron angrily pushed the water cup away.
Is it your intention to treat me as some sort of invalid? I'm still the Prime Minister's special advisor on all matters dealing with security and intelligence. I'm still the...
His voice trailed off with a sudden fatigue.
You're still the Mamuna, Gabriel said, finishing the sentence for him.
In Hebrew, Mamuna meant the one in charge. For many years, the title had been reserved for Shamron.
You're not going after some kid from Nablus, Gabriel. You have Ahmed bin Shafiq and Zizi al-Bakri in your sights. If something goes wrong, the world will fall on you from a very great height, and your friend Adrian Carter won't be there to help scrape you up. You might want to consider taking me into your confidence. I've done this sort of thing a time or two.
Gabriel poked his head into the corridor and asked the protective agents posted there to make certain any audio or visual surveillance of Shamron was switched off. Then he sat down again in the bedside chair and, with his mouth close to Shamron's ear, told him everything. Shamron's gaze, for a moment at least, seemed a little more focused. When he posed his first question, it was almost possible for Gabriel to conjure an image of the iron bar of a man who had walked into his life one September afternoon in 1972.
You've made up your mind about using a woman.
Gabriel nodded.
You're going to need someone whose story will withstand the scrutiny of Zizi's well-paid security staff. You can't use one of our girls, and you can't use a non-Israeli Jew. If Zizi even suspects he's looking at a Jewish girl, he'll give her a very wide berth. You need a Gentile.
What I need, said Gabriel, is an American girl.
Where are you going to get one?
Gabriel's one-word answer caused Shamron to frown.
I don't like the idea of us being responsible for one of their agents. What if something goes wrong?
What could go wrong?
Everything, Shamron said. You know that better than anyone.
Shamron seemed suddenly weary. Gabriel lowered the dimmer on the bedside lamp.
What are you going to do? Shamron asked. Read me a bedtime story.
I'm going to sit with you until you fall asleep.
Gila can do that. Go home. Get some rest. You're going to need it.
I'll stay for a while.
Go home, Shamron insisted. There's someone waiting there who's anxious to see you.
20 minutes later, when Gabriel turned into Narkis Street, he saw lights burning in his apartment. He parked his Skoda around the corner and stole quietly up the darkened walkway into the building. As he slipped inside the apartment, the air was heavy with the scent of vanilla. Kiara was seated cross-legged atop his examination table in the harsh light of his halogen work lamps. She scrutinized Gabriel as he came inside, then turned her gaze once more to what had once been a meticulously decorated living room.
I like what you've done with the place, Gabriel. Please tell me you didn't give away our bed, too.
Gabriel shook his head, then kissed her.
How long are you in town? She asked.
I leave tomorrow morning.
As usual, my timing is perfect. How long will you be gone?
Hard to say.
Can you take me with you?
Not this time.
Where are you going?
Gabriel eased her off the examination table and switched off the lights. Chapter 13, London.
I need a Van Gogh, Julian.
Don't we all, Petal?
Isherwood pushed back his coat sleeve and glanced at his wristwatch. It was 10 a.m. He was usually in his gallery by now, not strolling along the lakeshore in St. James's Park. He paused for a moment to watch a flotilla of ducks slicing through the calm water toward the island. Gabriel used the opportunity to cast his eyes around the park to see if they were being followed. Then he hooked Isherwood by the inside of the elbow and towed him toward the horse guards' road. They were a mismatched pair, figures from different paintings. Gabriel wore dark jeans and suede brogues that made no sound as he walked. His hands were thrust into the pockets of his leather jacket, his shoulders were slouched forward, and his green eyes were flickering restlessly about the park. Isherwood, 15 years older than Gabriel and several inches taller, wore a chalk-striped suit and woolen overcoat. His gray locks hung over the back of his coat collar and floated up and down with each lanky, loose-limbed stride. There was something precarious about Julian Isherwood. Gabriel, as always, had to resist an urge to reach out and steady him. They had known each other for 30 years. Isherwood's backbone of England surname and English scale concealed the fact that he was not, at least technically, English at all. British by nationality and passport, yes, but German by birth, French by upbringing, and Jewish by religion. Only a handful of trusted friends knew that Isherwood had staggered into London as a child refugee in 1942, after being carried across the snowbound Pyrenees by a pair of Basque shepherds, or that his father, the renowned Paris art dealer Samuel Isakowitz, had been murdered at the Sobibor death camp along with Isherwood's mother. There was something else Isherwood kept secret from his competitors in the London art world, and from nearly everyone else, for that matter. In the lexicon of the office, Julian Isherwood was a Sayan, a volunteer Jewish helper. He had been recruited by Ari Shamron for a single purpose, to help build and maintain the cover of a single very special agent.
"How's my friend Mario Del Vecchio?" Isherwood asked.
"Vanished without a trace," said Gabriel. "I hope my unveiling didn't cause you any problems."
"None whatsoever."
"No rumors on the street, no awkward questions at the auctions, no visits from the men of MI5.
"Are you asking me whether people in London regard me as a poisonous Israeli spy?"
"That's exactly what I'm asking you."
"All quiet on this front. But then we were never very flashy about our relationship, were we? That's not your way. You're not flashy about anything. One of the 2 or 3 best art restorers in the world, and no one really knows who you are. It's a shame, that."
They came to the corner of Great George Street. Gabriel led them to the right, into Birdcage Walk.
"Who knows about us in London, Julian? Who knows that you had a professional relationship with Mario?"
This is the end of disc number 3. Please insert disc number 4.